I'm here to talk about a little thing that I built. Now, this being Lisa and Usenix, marketing is not allowed. So I'm going to tell you everything about about the device except what it does. So that's my secret. However, as soon as my talk is over, I'll be passing out advertising material to everybody in here. So keep that in mind. If you want to follow along with my PDF, there's a URL for you, which I won't actually say. So we don't want to get confused there, but you can follow along and it'll be there for a while anyway. So I built a thing, and I brought one of the things, I'll cover up the logo, right? So I brought one of the things with me, and it's actually working, and I was actually able to connect over the Usenix wireless network from my laptop to the thing, and depending on how much time I have left at the end of my 45-minute segment, or not, I might show you how it actually works or not. I will move my little hand cursor down to the bottom, so it's out of the way. So this is what I'm talking about today, a networked computing appliance product. So a self-contained thing that sits there and you don't deal with it as you would a regular general purpose computer. And just for clarification, it's not one of these. I thought it was a lovely color though, so I may change my case. So I had an idea for a thing, and this was a few years back that I had an idea. And actually, if I was going to be honest, I would say it was more than a few years back that I had an overall idea. But in the intervening years, I've kind of refined the idea and tidied it down. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the process I went through. So I had an idea for a thing, and over time, I refined the idea to be a little more focused and to be a little more reflective of what I thought might be useful for people. And I learned many things in the process, some of which are technical things I learned, some of which are absolutely not technical things that I learned, and I won't touch on those so much today. And so this, of course, is the story of the thing, this thing here. So the big idea, what I was trying to accomplish, I wanted to have a device I could put on a remote network that I didn't necessarily control or have access to. I wanted to put a thing on that network and get information from that thing in one way or another. And so the device had to be fairly self-contained. It had to be able to kind of configure itself or at least default to a reasonable configuration. And because I'm talking about remote networks, so for example, maybe I've got a chain of retail stores and they're scattered all across the continent and I want to put one in each of these retail stores. And really, I don't want to have to call up the stock clerk at that retail store and say, oh, by the way, could you go to this device and plug in a keyboard and a display and then type what I'm about to tell you? I thought that would be not really a good plan. So the basic idea, I wanted to build a self-contained thing that I could put somewhere and interact with it in some way. As I said, I originally had a big idea, and this goes back a few years, and it was going to be all singing and all dancing, and it was going to include the kitchen sink and all those things. And over the years, I saw some other people do something that was kind of similar to that overall idea, and they had much, much bigger budgets than I had, or have, or ever will have, and all those other people that built those things, they're all gone now. So either I had a terrible idea, maybe I still have a terrible idea, or maybe they had bad execution or something, but I thought if I take the big idea and make it into a smaller, more focused idea, that might work a little better. And so, original idea and tiny little final idea. And I think that's actually in italics, bold in italics, so that's the differentiator there. So what I figured was if I've got a big idea, a big technical idea, and I want to make it a little smaller, the larger idea takes a lot longer to implement and get everything right. There's a whole bunch of more different parts to it, and it's a little riskier because you're asking people to, buy into my entire view of the world. And if I took my idea and focused it down a little bit with the idea that here's a much more comprehensible, I hope, device that people can look at it. I can give them a quick description of what it does, and they might say, okay, I understand that. I know how I can use it. Now, for example, I used to be fairly quick up here, and I think as time goes on, I'm getting a little slower. So there's a thing that people always talk about, Hadoop and MapReduce. And I wish I could just go to the website and it would say, and here is an example of how you might apply it. All those websites, they talk about things in big, big, grandiose, generic terms. I wanted to be able to tell people, my device does this little thing. And they'd say, oh, that's perfect, I'll buy one. Or give me one for free because I'm nice. And I also thought a more focused idea It's easier for one person to do, and it's easier to adjust it along the way. If you have the world-shattering idea, changing that as you go is maybe not an easy thing to do. So my original idea had to do with have a device, and you could connect to the device, and you could do management on it. So it has its regular tasks, but anything you put on a network, you may have to configure somehow. Maybe you need to give it a static IP address or tell it where your DNS servers are, or tell it to reboot or apply software updates or things like that. I started with the idea that you would probably be able to directly connect to it. So even if it's in remote locations, maybe you've got a VPN connection or you've got a private link or some mechanism for getting there. So I had the idea that, okay, I'll put a web interface on it for web-based management, but you could also SSH into the box and do limited management that way. And also, if you had a console that you hooked up to the box itself, you could do basic configuration there. So if your network configuration was all screwed up and had a static IP address that did not reflect the current state of your network, you could connect to the console and change things up that way. But it was all predicated on the idea and the tasks it was actually trying to do. There's little arrows down here, I don't know if you can see them, but the idea of I want the device to do some work, and the work I was going to have it do would be the user or the thing originating the work would connect directly to the appliance, the device, and the device would do some work against some target out there, and the information would come back from through the appliance to the user. So I could connect directly to it and use it as a proxy or as a surrogate worker for me or something, but connecting directly to it. And that was my original idea, and the assumption that you could reach it on the network. And I was talking to somebody about a little over a year ago, and I'd already kind of come to this conclusion myself, and originally I had the idea that maybe that thing could go out and ask for work to do and connect to some sort of server somewhere. And I'd refined that about a year and a half ago to be maybe you could put more control in a central location. So if you don't have access to the device, then maybe you'd still be okay. So I flipped it around. And the basic assumption is that you probably cannot get there to that network from wherever you happen to be. So you probably don't have a VPN connection, or you don't want to open every hole in the firewall, or it's, you know, you can't SSH in or things like that. So I wanted the device to be able to configure itself up and take direction from somewhere else. And of course, because everything is a web service these days, it was all going to talk SSL, HTTPS, and it would only be outbound connections. So the use case, again, is that the user or whatever wants the work to be done contacts a manager of some kind, which in my implementation is a web service out on the interwebs, tells the management service, this is what I want this device to do. This device calls in every once in a while and says, what would you like me to do? And goes away and does that and reports results back either directly to the user, if that's possible, or through a proxy, the manager service there. And so the nice thing about that was that you only need outbound HTTPS from wherever the device is, and you don't have to worry about VPN connections or conflicting IP address ranges or anything like that. And you probably didn't have to touch the device at all, ever. So for example, if you want to send this to your office out in California, you could just, you don't even have to open the package, just send it out there, tell them, plug it into the network, and it'll all just work. That's my theory. I'm kind of doing okay so far. The complication is, I don't know if you can see the little blue light up here, but there's a Wi-Fi connection on this particular box. And it's kind of hard to configure the Wi-Fi configuration if you can't get the device on the network to start with. So that's a chicken and egg thing, but small potatoes. So in order to build the thing, I wanted to build a special purpose device, but I wanted to use general purpose hardware and a general purpose operating system. Part of the reason for that is I wanted things to be, you know, reasonably cost-effective. I didn't want to have specialized hardware. I didn't have to want to have to license complicated, expensive embedded operating systems. And to be honest, I didn't want to have to learn about all those embedded operating systems and embedded real-time programming or anything like that. So I wanted to take general-purpose hardware, general-purpose operating system, and make a thing that did a special thing. And I even put this in bold down there. Part of the reason for doing that is I wanted things to be cost-effective and reliable. Now, I said earlier that I'd come up with this idea a few years back. And I don't know if you guys have noticed, but hardware has changed over the past, 5, 6, 10 years. And what was available 10 years ago is a little different from what's available today. And so as time went by, I was trying to figure out, I've got this idea, but I want something really self-contained. How can I implement that? So the first thing I looked at was a generic Intel box, a rack-mounted box. It's not so deep necessarily. This one happens to be, I think it's 17 inches deep. So it doesn't take up the whole depth of your rack, and it doesn't need special power and things like that. And I don't know if you can see it, this one has a CD drive in the front corner. But from companies like Crystal Fonts and Matrix Orbital, they make LCD displays, and they also make little brackets that will fit in a half-height slot. So my idea was I could get an Intel box, and I could put an LCD display with a tiny little keypad on there, and that's all you'd need to do initial configuration if you were so inclined. And because you could put the device's name on the LCD display, let me tell you about my PIN number later and my SSN number too. But so you can just put the name of the device on the display, and then people don't have to go around and make little labels and stick it on the device that's in their data center. So I thought that'd be good. Having a display would be good. I don't know if you noticed, no actual display on the finished device. And then I thought, okay, reduce, reuse, recycle. About 10 years ago, Cobalt, who was bought by Sun, and then Sun killed the product, and then Sun was bought by Oracle, and we all know what happened to Sun then. So if they had not killed this product, they'd still be with us. So the Cobalt Rack 3 appliance, there was an earlier one, a Rack 2, which used a MIPS processor. The Rack 3 has an Intel processor. I think it's an AMD something. But it's a self-contained box, room for one disk inside. It's got a display and little buttons, and it's only about yay deep, like 9 or 10 inches deep, or 25 centimeters deep, for those of us that are Canadian or European or anywhere but, here. And I thought this was pretty cool, and I was looking at this, and it was kind of okay, but stocks of these things were not really as common as they once were. People started looking at them and saying, this is crap, and just throwing it out into the electronics recycling. So there weren't many of them available, but I could get them, for $125 and put some memory in and put a compact flash card in instead of a regular spinning disk. So it would work out okay, but I was still thinking maybe it was a little bigger than I really wanted to end up with, a little more costly and harder to come by as time went on. Probably not a good idea to base a product on something that is becoming more and more rare. It's my business training that brings me that. So. And I thought, okay, how about a mini ITX system with a little tiny motherboard that are cheaper? This is from a company called mini-box.com. And they'll sell you this little box, and it's got a display in it. And the display was actually pretty cheap. To add on the display with the keyboard here is only about $50 or $60. So it's not extortionate like some vendors. And this was kind of cool. It's got a compact flash slot in the front there, and you don't have to buy a disk with it. It's a generic PC. And this was getting closer. One problem with this, it looks kind of about this tall, but really it's about this tall. It's about half an inch more than a rack unit, and I just found that offensive. So, but it was not bad. It was getting closer. There's a whole bunch of other embedded kinds of computers out there that I looked at. This is a Socris board. This is, I think, a 4801. Socris has made basically little boxes intended for firewalls or access points for a number of years. Very nice boxes, but and they have sell nice little metal cases, all sorts of good things. I have a couple of firewalls running mono wall that are built on Socris boxes. For me, the problem with this was relatively low power, low CPU power. So I think this one has a 233 megahertz something in it and low amounts of memory. This has 128 megabytes of memory. I think you can upgrade this one to 256 if you buy that model. But you can't get, I thought that the memory would be a little constraining for what I wanted to do. And again, this box is about $225. The previous one, the ITX box, about $300. This is about $220 with a case. So not bad, but not really where I want it to be. Plug computers, they started to become available a couple years ago. And basically, it's a little ARM computer with a USB connection, an Ethernet, a place where you can stick in an SD card. They've got typically 512 or now about a gig of memory on the board. You stick in they've got some persistent RAM that acts like a disk, or you can use an SD card. And this was getting closer. And this is a Marvell Shiva plug. This is an older model, but about $100. So, you know, we're kind of in the range of where we want it to be. But it's kind of a weird-looking thing. And if you bought one of those, you'd say, well, I can only use it for this one thing. So I kind of thought, still wasn't hitting the way I wanted. So about a year and a half ago, these nice people in England thought they could build a new computer, and they might sell 2,000 of them if they were lucky. And they called it the Raspberry Pi Model B. And they thought, you know, if we can do 2,000 and do a little education, this will be a good thing. Of course, sometime in the past year, they've sold their millionth Raspberry Pi. So it's doing better than they expected to. And the Raspberry Pi, I thought, well, look, this could be a good match for what I was looking for. So it's got a network, it's got a place for an SD card in the end, it's got USB, it's got video on it, it's got GPIO pins on it, so if you wanted to expand it, I don't want to expand it, but other people do. And so I thought, this for me, in the notes, if you downloaded the PDF, there's a second page with some little notes, elaboration and details on there. And if you're old like me, you might recognize this for the Piranha Brothers was the turning point, which apparently none of you are as old as me, or nobody likes Monty Python. But I thought this may be what I was looking for. So that's where I went. And so this thing in here, inside this box, is a Raspberry Pi. This is a case from some nice people, and an SD card, and various things like that. So I chose the hardware, Raspberry Pi. Need to choose an operating system. I'm a free BSD bigot from a way back, because BSD is the way to go. Not everybody agrees with that. I had seen examples of other appliances that people had built, notably the Monowall Firewall, which is FreeBSD, NanoBSD based. Actually, I don't know if it predates NanoBSD or if it's about the same vintage. And the PFSense Firewall, which is kind of a derivative of the Monowall. But those are BSD based, and they seem to do some nice things and have good, reliable things that were essentially appliances that could be deployed. But I observed that the choice of hardware, now that I've chosen my hardware, it may restrict the operating system that I'll choose. So I'll mention a couple of options here. So FreeBSD has NanoBSD. NanoBSD is really nice. Basically, you divide your flash card into two partitions, or maybe three partitions, but you've got two operating system partitions. You put an OS image on one of them, and when you want to do an upgrade, you download a complete image, put it on the other partition, and boot to that other partition. So the way NanoBSD is built, you're very unlikely to shoot yourself in the foot and destroy the machine when you do an upgrade, which is a good feature. And you build the image on a regular FreeBSD box, and it does all the right things. It's got mechanisms in it for knowing that it's got a read-only disk and things like that. So NanoBSD is pretty cool. Didn't work for what I needed because of the hardware, basically. Fedora has for many years, I think probably going back, I know going back to Fedora 5, has a mechanism built into the RC scripts that if you put an RC read-only script in the right place, they've got hooks in there if you want to make your root file system read-only. And I thought that was kind of cool. And I had shown you a picture of the Cobalt Rack 3 earlier, and I've had one of those Rack 3s running in my house for about 3, maybe 4 years now, running off a flash card with a read-only file system using the Fedora hooks. And that's worked out pretty well. The nice thing, I live in a house. I have no UPS. The computers crash occasionally. Having a read-only file system that does not corrupt itself when it loses power, that's a good feature. And remember, I said I wanted my thing to be reliable, so that's a good thing to have. So FreeBSD would be good, yeah. Fedora would be good. I used Fedora 5 for the LCD support for the Cobalt Rack 3 on the Rack 3. But for the Raspberry Pi, I concluded that going with the status quo, you know, what everybody else is doing, was probably a good idea, which means a Debian variant called the Raspbian. So I told you that FreeBSD has NanoBSD, and Fedora 5 has the root file system read-only stuff, and Debian has a lot of fans. So I decided to build my thing on the Raspbian variant of Debian. Raspbian comes as an SD card image. Up until recently, it was a 2 gig image, but now for the full noob version, you need a 4 gig flash card, SD card. So instead of paying $3 for the SD card, you have to pay $3.50 for the SD card, but you can get them at the drugstore, whereas you can't get a 2 gig card at the drugstore, of course. And Raspbian was nice. The Raspberry Pi has a particular kind of hardware floating point, and the stock Debian ARM distribution does not have built-in support for that hardware floating point. The Raspbian people recompiled everything, so now I get floating point that's a little less inefficient on this device. And it was available relatively early on, and it's the kind of standard way of doing it. There are variants. There are alternative OSs available for Raspberry Pi. There's a FreeBSD version. There's an Arch Linux. There's a couple other Linuxes. There are various canned distributions. For example, if you need a media center, XBMC, there's an XBMC distribution for the Raspberry Pi and all that. I went with the stock Raspbian. I'll talk later about what I take apart with it. So as I mentioned, I had done a couple of previous steps before the Raspberry Pi was available. I built a thing on I got various bits of hardware at my house. I built an implementation on the Cobalt Rack 3. I have a version running on just a regular, I have one that's running on an Intel VM under VMware and things like that. I looked at different bits of hardware and things like that. So these were kind of missteps, you know, moving forward a little, moving back. The nice thing about this as a side effect was now my code is relatively portable because I know how to deal with a Red Hat operating system, Debian or FreeBSD. If I wanted to implement on a different piece of hardware, I could choose a different underlying OS if I wanted to make my life more difficult. So I learned a few lessons there. Packaging up software. I mentioned that NanoBSD starts with the idea that build everything you want into one big monolithic image. If you're doing an upgrade, put the entire monolithic image on the new flash card partition and boot from that. I figured that I would do my bits of software as regular standard operating system packages, you know, either RPMs or DEBs. And part of my rationale for that was it's easy to go with the status quo, which is sometimes a good thing. I thought I would probably have to rebuild some stock packages. I don't have a really good example off the top of my head, but I may want to rebuild a package to remove the documentation because I don't want to waste that space, or maybe something comes only in an X Windows with all the X Windows extensions. I might want to rebuild it without the X Windowing stuff built in, and so I'll have my own version. So being able to repackage existing stuff, make my own revision of the package, and using that, I thought that was a good idea. If I'm already doing packages for some things, I may as well put all my software in packages as well and set up dependencies and things like that. One of the things people always say, now some of you out there I'm sure use Debian or Ubuntu or things like that, and everybody says the best thing about Debian is the package management. The apt package management stuff is fabulous. And every time I look at it, it just makes me sad. The first example I'll just give you is there's a command called apt-get. And you use apt-get to install packages. But of course, you can also use apt-get to remove packages. So apt-get remove package name, which semantically to me makes absolutely no sense. And you know, you want to install something, apt-get install, you know, the Department of Redundancy department. So it's not my favorite. And building the deb packages just seemed more complicated to me. Now, we are all more comfortable with what we grew up with. And so I'm happier with punched cards, but given that I had to deal with a Debian, I thought going with the deb packages. So part of this is me just being a crotchety, cranky old man, so, you know, keep that in mind. One of the things I did was I first built RPMs for the Rack 3, and I thought, oh, these spec files are ugly and annoying, and what if I wanted to build a FreeBSD package for NanoBSD or something? So I ended up using a thing called EPM, Easy Package Manager, which is basically you give it a generic configuration file and you can have it build Solaris or packages or FreeBSD or RPMs or DEBs or various other variants and things like that. And for me that worked out pretty well because it gave me a level of abstraction and the configuration file, to me at least, was more comprehensible than a spec file. So I used that. And when I started doing the Raspberry Pi, I could use that same configuration file to generate a deb without too much trouble. So it wasn't too bad. The one thing I ran into, which just it took me like a week to figure out how to do this, and maybe it's because, you know, I'm not that smart, but we'll see. So with an RPM, and you want to make a repository, well, I guess I better move along quickly. So you make an RPM, you put it in a directory, you say create repo. If you want to make a Debian repository, you make the deb file, and then you make a directory hierarchy, and then you remove the file if it was already there in all the indexes, and then you re-add it there, and then I just found it much more convoluted than I thought it had to be. But I have repositories. So the basic bits of the software is I needed to have a configuration mechanism, I needed to have management tools, I needed to have the software to let the thing actually do the stuff. So what I did is I built a bunch of shell scripts, basically, that would do all sorts of behind-the-scenes work, and I could put a menu system in front of that for the console. So if you go to the console or if you SSH into the device to do configuration, there's a menu system that comes up there. And of course, I have a web interface, and the web interface is just a bunch of PHP that mostly just invokes shell scripts behind the scenes. And that way I built the infrastructure, and then I built the interface on top of the infrastructure. And of course, I got all sorts of standard packages from the OS, like Lighty. I don't understand how L-I-G-H-T-T-P-D is pronounced Lighty, but apparently it is, and SSH and things like that. I built myself a little toolbox that would do manage configuration. So I had to have some local configuration on the box, the options. Maybe you need to set a static IP address. You want certain programs running on this box. You need some local configuration. I built some tools to manipulate a local configuration file. And remember, that's stored on the normally read-only root file system at this point. So it does various little tricks to avoid writing it if it doesn't have to write it. The idea being that flash memory, at least historically, you don't want to write it over and over and over again because it'll wear out. So I have little tools. I can set config and save the config. I have a small amount of per machine specific configuration. So when I deploy a machine, I put a machine.cfg file on it that says, this is your name, and this is the magic password that you should use to contact the management server. And then a bunch of periodic tools that run every hour or 15 minutes, do background stuff and maintenance and stuff like that. And these tools will also remove standard parts of the operating system if need be. And I kind of mentioned this, I was just trying to reinforce the idea that I built a bunch of CLI tools, and then I put a web or a menuing interface in front of that. And that was a big advantage when I decided to do an API as well. I could have the API commands apply to these mechanisms that already existed, which worked out well for me. So here's my theoretical question for today. If a machine crashes and you're not actually there to understand what it's doing, what will it do to itself? And most of us know that if it's a Unix box or a Linux box and you unplug the power and you plug it back in, you'll probably have to type FSCK-Y, crap. And so I had one of these sitting at home. This was about a year ago, and it was just plugged in and the power failed, or my kid knocked the power plug out or something. And it really destroyed its SD card, and I thought that was a bad, bad thing. So that was the motivation to take the read-only root file system stuff I'd done under Fedora and apply it to the Debian, the Raspbian image. So it was until that fateful day. I was trying to lead a virtuous life and hoping that would serve me in good stead, and apparently I was not leading a virtuous enough life and had to rebuild that SD card completely. So now I have a mechanism on here, which is basically what I copied from what I'd done for the Fedora. When the machine boots up, very early in the boot process, it makes a memory, a tempfs memory-backed slash TMP file system, and it makes a directory in there that I could put various things. And then it does a lot of copy the files off the disk, put them over there, and make a bind mount into the right place. So for example, var temp is mounted on temp, and it's a memory file system as well, or var run is a memory file system over there. So if you do df on this box, there's a list of about 15 things that are mounted. Some of them are directories, some of them are actually files, just a single file mounted read write. And I built a set of tools. I reused the tools from a couple years back to manage it. So I can say, run this command with a read-only root. So do rwvi config file if I'm breaking things myself. One nice side effect of this is if somebody goes into the machine and is just poking around and finds that the file system is read-only, if it's somebody in this room, they'll say, well, I can defeat that. I'm sure I can. But it just gives people a heads up that, you know, don't go poking your fingers around here because something will go wrong, which hopefully makes the device more reliable. I mentioned earlier the local console runs a simple menu, so you can set networking and turn SSH on and off, things like that. You can reboot. And you can get shell access if you need to poke around. Hopefully regular people don't have to poke around, but I like to be able to do that. And there's a local web interface running under Lighty with PHP that lets you configure all the local things and turn processes on and off and things like that. And as I said, the read-only route makes it harder to break. One thing I found out, though, when you go read-write and you do package updates and you restart a daemon like cron, for example, if it's updated, you can't go back to a read-only file system because that file is open on a read-write file system. So the binary, even though you're not going to change the binary, it prevents you from getting back to read-only. Minor inconvenience, but we can deal with it. So remote management. I have a central management server. It runs on a computer in a data center somewhere. There's SSL connections to it. And every machine, all these little devices, they check in with that management server periodically, every 15 minutes. Says, do you have something for me to do? And from that management server, you can say, here are the tasks that I want you to do in a couple of different formats. But you can also say, and apply software updates, or here's your Wi-Fi network configuration settings, assuming that you have one existing Wi-Fi connection that's actually working. Or, so I said reboot or update your software and things like that. It gives you, the management interface gives you information about the current IP address of where the thing is. So if I go to the management interface right now, if the Wi-Fi hasn't fallen over, I'll have an IP address for this, and there's dynamic DNS that runs. So that this machine happens to be called Little, my domain, and I have dynamic DNS. So if you look at the front here, you may be able to find it if you're on the local network and can get to it. I'll mention the API in a moment. So I worried about security and reliability. So I make the read-only file system, which is kind of okay. The console access, if you plug a keyboard and an HDMI monitor into this box, it does not require a password, so you can just reset the password or get shell access. And I figured if you're in front of this little box, which is held together with screws and it's got an SD card inside it, there's no point in restricting access on the console because you could just take the box apart, take the SD card out, and mount it in any computer you feel like. And also, then I don't have to worry about password reset requests, right, because I can do it that way. So if you can get to it, all the traffic over the network is generally encrypted, so SSH or SSL connections. The management access, there's tokens back and forth that are supposed to be secret and using various key swapping and things like that. So moderately secure and reliable. It's obviously not for a high security environment, and it will not withstand a determined attack. But a determined attack, if you're already on your local network, and you could get to where this thing is, you could plug your own computer into the wire, and so it's not going to give you much advantage if you break into that box, my theory goes. I learned that I have a belief that non-monolithic tools make things easier. So for example, I was thinking about BusyBox last night as I was editing some of these notes. BusyBox is one binary that does like 40 different things, easy to maintain, harder to mess around with, but easier to maintain in terms of doing an update. You update one file. But building it and making everything tied together is a little more complicated. I'm in the Unix philosophy. I built a bunch of small tools that go together. I need some sort of development environment. This is an ARM processor, so I can't run it under VMware, but it does work more or less under QEMU, on my 64-bit machine, so I can have a couple of virtual ones. And because the Raspberry Pi itself is cheap enough, you can buy spares and run local development. And I have hooks in there that I can have a local software repository so I can make new versions of packages that will only hit my development machines. And I can also NFS mount the web pages. So if I'm tweaking web pages, I don't even have to do software updates against my development logs. It's just kind of a reasonable approach, I think, for doing it. When I'm building one of these boxes, I say, okay, this is going to be called, this one's called Little, for example. When I built this, I said, I knew that was the name I was going to give it. I have a standard SD card image that has no configuration information on it. Put it in the box, tidy up the box, plug it into the network. It tries to connect to an internal web server, asks for a configuration file named for the Raspberry Pi serial number that's available in /process/CPU info. Ask for the configuration file. I look in my Apache error logs, find out what file it's asking for. Now I know the serial number on this particular board, and I can know the MAC address. I give it, here's your name I want you to use, and here's your magic secret password to get to software updates and things like that. And then it does a bunch of housekeeping, removes a bunch of stuff, makes sure the file system is as big as it should be, and then prints out an instruction sheet. Here's the password that I've just made up for this device, and with a MAC address and things like that, and I can put it in a box, and it's ready to be used. And then I use my boot server to register the information about this particular device, the MAC address, the serial number, the name, into the central management server. So when a customer comes along, they have that device, and they can tell information about the device. I'm just looking at my clock here. Okay, there we go. I mentioned most of this. There's a central management service. It summarizes the work, the real actual work that the device is doing, but also lets you manage the devices themselves. As I mentioned, updates and reboots and things like that. You can get an overview of all the devices that are attached to your account and things like that. So there's a place. You don't actually have to connect to this box. You can do it interactively. The management service also has an API. So if I have an existing management tool managing my configuration for the work that this thing actually does, I can use the API on my source controlled server, you know, whether I'm, you know, if I've got a Git repo where I keep all my information, I can have a script that uses the API to tell the management server this is the work. I knew I should have worn a button-up shirt today, but that's how it goes. So you can use the API and tell the management server, this is the work I want this box to do, or by the way, do software updates against all the devices that I happen to have. And I'm an old school guy. There's no XML, no JSON, no YAML. It's just keyword equals value, more or less. What do I worry about? Well, I told you that the idea is that you can deploy these things in remote locations that you may not have access to. And I do software updates, and you can say apply the updates whenever you want. And what happens if I make a software update and sadly I made a mistake and it turns off the network? So I worry about things like that. And it also currently uses the standard Raspbian deb repositories. What happens if a standard update comes out that doesn't fit in with my way of doing things, and so I've suddenly got these boxes out on the network that I can't get to that now no longer work and need manual intervention? That would be a very, very bad thing. So in order to mitigate that, I sacrifice live chickens from time to time, but I also have different package repositories. So currently I have just internal and external, but I'm going to have different levels of bleeding edge, I'm okay, or really I want to be conservative kind of repositories. The idea being that if I do an update and the update's wrong, I will not break everything instantly. One of the things I've seen weird, especially in hotels, the Wi-Fi, it's very simple-minded Wi-Fi, and sometimes it ends up on the wrong network or does the wrong thing. Not great. SD cards, I've tried to, they can fail. This particular case has a cover over the SD card. Most Raspberry Pi cases leave the card easy to pull out for whatever reason. I worry about the card falling out or the card failing. With the card being read-only, hopefully the card itself won't fail, and with the case protecting it, hopefully it won't fall out. Or if the Raspberry Pi itself fails, there's hardware that has to be shipped back and forth. Hopefully it's not going to happen very much, knock on wood. And of course, I've got enhancements and things like that, additional tools for integration that are all kind of domain-specific for the work that the device is actually doing. And I got plans going forward of various things like that. And I think I'm almost exactly, I've got like 3 minutes left in my allotted time. So I, of course, can talk all day about this, and if I was talking about the particular problem domain, I could talk even more about it. So if you're interested, certainly track me down. I'm more than happy to talk about it. Something that I did not mention here. So this is intended to be a product that hopefully people will buy and hopefully will make their lives easier. I talked about how I did it technically, making a product. There are so many other things to making a product than the technical stuff. The technical stuff is this much work, and the other stuff is this much work. So there's documentation, there's actually buying the parts, putting things together, shipping stuff out, convincing people that they really need one of these or 100 of these, things like that. So it adds a little more excitement. And I've got 2 minutes, I hope, questions. And if you have a question, please use a microphone.
Hi. Out of all the hardware options you looked at, what are your thoughts on some of the physical security aspects? Which platform would have been the best fit for from a physical security perspective?
So a physical security aspect of hardware, I'm of a couple of different minds. So in my particular problem domain, I didn't worry about the physical security very much. If you're making things like wireless access points or network access points, you worry about it more. And to my mind, I think that's more dictated in many cases by the kind of case or enclosure you put the thing in. If you make it hard to get at the hardware, I think you might be better off. But again, you know, the physical security was not something I worried too much about. Thank you very much.